Our guest has been involved in Māori education for a long time and has written a memoir about what being Pākehā means to her. Award-winning author Alison Jones's new book is This Pākehā Life, an Unsettled Memoir. It's an insight into New Zealand's social history and Māori-Pākehā relationships and what she describes as, quote, the ambivalence we Pākehā often experience in our relationships with Māori. It's an invitation for Pākehā to look at ideas about identity and belonging, and it's also Alison's own story of her becoming and being Pākehā. The daughter of working-class British migrants, born in Auckland, she grew up in Dannevirke and today is professor in the Faculty of Education and Social Work at the University of Auckland in the School of Māori and Indigenous Education, the Puna Wānanga. Alison is in the Auckland studio, and tamaki makaurau. Tēnā koe and welcome, Alison.
Kia ora, Catherine.
So you've been writing, and this book is for whom, do you think, this time?
Well, this book's specifically for Pākehā, and probably many of the people that I teach, actually, because, and my friends, and a lot of Pākehā who I've had conversations with over the years about their relationships with Māori, and as you say, about their ambivalences. So many Pākehā, I find, have a real range of emotions about Māori, their relationships with Māori, about the Māori world, about the treaty, often, you know, confused or just not certain, sometimes anxious, sometimes angry, and often really quite ignorant. And I suppose I've encountered that questioning, that anxiety and ambivalence quite a lot. And people have said to me, because I'm a Pākehā, they say, well, how do you approach all these things? Because you're working in Te Ao Māori, you're working with Māori colleagues and friends and students. How do you get on with all this? You know, and they sort of seem to see me as some kind of specimen of specialness, and that I'm brave or weird or something, and often quite curious. And so when I get that question, how did you get involved in all this? Then I can go back to look at my history and the many, many years that it's taken me to get to this point, I suppose, in my relationships with Te Ao Māori.
Are you noticing changes when you think of, you know, the 1970s, the land marches into the Waitangi Tribunal, into Bastion Point, into the treaty settlements, into moving from... someone being the telephone operator famously being banned for saying kia ora, to where we are with the rail now and a broadening acceptance of the rail. Are you seeing and tracking changes in people over time?
Yes, certainly, particularly amongst Pākehā. I think Māori have been consistent in their viewpoint ever, you know, for basically 200 years. It's not that that's changed hugely, but I think in terms of Pākehā awareness, Pākehā willingness to be open and interested, actually learning Te Reo Māori, listening to Māori political views and so on, I think that has shifted. And what I notice mostly is in the very young generation. You know, I have my grandchildren speak the Māori vowels correctly, completely effortlessly, and they don't find Māori issues or Māori culture or Te Reo Māori strange in the way that my generation did. But, you know, I'm in my 60s, and for many, even for generations after me, up probably until my children's generation, there was this sort of very strong separation, I think. Although people say to me, well, you know, obviously you didn't live in small towns. Well, I actually did live in small towns, not in complete rural areas, where, of course, there was a lot of mixing of Māori and Pākehā socially in the pub and down at the sports field. But in term, I'm not just talking about individuals getting on. I'm talking about the worlds, you know, the Pākehā world, if you like, to put it simply, in the Māori world, in terms of the marae, the pā, the tangihanga, the spiritual and political and historical aspects of Māori being. I think Pākehā have often said, oh yes, I get on with Māori fine, I've got a Māori workmate or Māori work for me or something like that, but don't really have any sense of those of the Māori world in its larger being.
Dame Nida Glavish it was. Of course, I was trying to recall with the famous Kia Ora, which has stayed in time. And it shows us what has changed. But you're talking about things that are much more fundamental. I am curious as to whether some of what you're talking about has been a subject of people feeling under attack or being put on the defensive about who they are and what they do or don't feel responsible for. And again, are you seeing that ease even in generations for whom it seemed to be a reflex reaction for a long time?
When you say, sorry, Catherine, when you say people under attack, do you mean...
People feeling under attack and feeling... feeling defensive, people. Yes. Yeah.
Feeling under attack from Māori?
Well, no. Just feeling like, as we have learned and as our worlds have mixed more and as we've been asked to confront our history and its impacts more over these decades, there can be a defence of this. There can be a feeling of Pākehā feeling like... they need to defend themselves or say, well, this was nothing to do with me. And I'm curious as to whether you're seeing that easing and more people saying, yes, of course this is our history and of course I'm willing to confront it.
Yes, I guess
you're not.
I guess so. It's interesting, and I'm just thinking about all the people I teach and talk to because I'm trying not to just rely on my own experience. I mean, as I write about in the book, my great-great-great-uncles actually fought in Taranaki and on the British side of the British. They were part of a British garrison who came here in Taranaki and in the Waikato Wars. I also have a great-great-grandfather who was a parliamentarian during the 1860s in New Zealand and seemed to accept these wars and wasn't on the side of those Pākehā who actually spoke up against what was happening to Māori. And in confronting that history, I find that I am... When I discovered it, in fact, I discovered it relatively recently, this historical link, and weirdly enough, I felt this sort of sense of relief and joy that I had this long connection with Aotearoa New Zealand. So it wasn't that I felt kind of defensive and awful. I thought, oh, okay, you know, I have this long, my actual family has this long history here. And sure, it's really problematic. I recognise that, but I also recognise that it's a history of engagement and being here. And I think that whatever we Pākehā might think about our colonial impact on Māori, which has been extreme, what we do need to do is just calmly face it. And, well, first of all, be aware of it, because I would say 90% plus Pākehā that I encounter really honestly do not know about our history. They know a few little things, but they actually don't know very much about the area that they were born or brought up in or live in. And when they actually find out about our history, they have a much stronger ground to stand on that's not so emotionally volatile, because they can see, okay, this happened. And I was, you know, my family or my people were involved in this kind of way. And I think facing it, accepting it, and seeing that we're part of this place deeply and how we move forward in that relationship is really what is what faces us now. I mean, you say that there's some kind of easing, that people are becoming more willing to look at our past. And I think that probably is the case because we've got so many excellent histories now that are written. Mostly, I have to say, by Pākehā writers like Anne Salmond and Vincent O'Malley, Judith Binney and so on, that are gripping stories that have been accessible to Pākehā who have been, so, you know, through that, have been able to really get to grips with our past.
There are some key moments where you have defining moments in how you see yourself as a Pākehā in relation to Māori. You really get some insights. Could you reflect on some of those for us?
Gosh, there are so many, really. I mean, the book really is about a series of relationships and a series of anecdotes, I suppose, throughout my whole life. I guess one of them that comes to mind is when I lived in Bethlehem, just outside of Tauranga. Our family moved around a lot when we were kids, and I was a teenager by the time we got to Bethlehem. And we lived on Carmichael's Road in Bethlehem, and the people from that area will know that road. And I found out quite by chance that Carmichael's Road was a confiscation line, or should I say, a line where confiscated land had been handed back to Māori, local Māori, who now lived on one side of that road and the rest of the land remained confiscated and was in Pākehā hands. And I was delivering papers. I was a paper girl, before dawn, up with the Herald, throwing it into the driveways of houses around the area. And I was very conscious that on one side of the road were Māori houses that were very poor, and on the other side of the road were Pākehā houses that were, where mine was, were reasonably well-heeled. And a couple of things happened. One was my brothers used to get beaten up by the Māori kids in the area for being Pākehā, and so they wouldn't go on the school bus. They had to go on their bicycles to school. And I didn't really think very much of it. But, I mean, I thought, well, you know, this is what happens. This is just kind of normal behaviour. Then when I thought more about it as an adult and read more about that area and how those children who were shouting "Aia Pākehā" to my brothers, their grandparents would have been brought up with stories of them actually starving on that land, that they had so little that was left after the confiscations, that they were very bitter, and that bitterness, of course, stayed in the people. And so although those children might not have explicitly known why they disliked Pākehā and were giving them a bash, there was something in the people there that was, you know, really had that legacy going into that behaviour. And the other thing that happened at that same time was the Springbok tours. There was a lot of talking about halting the tours with South Africa. At the time, we were debating whether to go to South Africa. And I remember on the radio, there were programs about poverty in South Africa and the racism in South Africa. And they showed the difference between black people's homes and white people's homes. And I remember distinctly, I was only, 15, maybe 14 at the time, thinking, but that's really similar to New Zealand, you know, because in the sense of my experience on that street. And I was really curious about why it was that the adults weren't talking about that. They were getting all hot and bothered about South Africa, but I could see that vast difference in equality and housing and so on in my very street. And those are the sorts of things, I guess, that's just one of many, many anecdotal stories I could tell about my childhood that I've reflected on at the time, but also reflected on more recently to understand in their larger setting.
What happens is there's a chapter on tricky memories, and this is interesting. Again, it's, I think, probably around the same time. And in one part, you discover a memory that you wrote about is actually completely wrong. Well, I mean, that can happen to any of us. We all misremember. Memory is all about rewriting history in some ways, isn't it? Mm. But again, this anecdote in the book, is this again about how you were trying to make sense of the world you were living in and the people in it at the time?
Ah, yes, tricky memories. Gosh, that was fascinating, yes. When I was about 8 years old, by this stage we were living in Dannevirke, and I remembered this sort of moment that I'd recalled so fondly, often through my life, as kind of a very important moment in my sort of falling in love with Te Ao Māori, with the Māori world. When I was 8, I was at primary school in Dannevirke, and I remember my friend Maria, who was the most wonderful Māori girl, full of life and happiness and sporty and all that, all the things I wanted to be. And I got invited to her place for lunch one day. It was over the road from school. It was during a school day. And I went over there, even though we weren't really allowed out of school for lunch, and sat in her house and had boil up at the table. Well, actually, I said no thanks because I brought my lunch with me. I was very shy. Went to her bedroom and we saw her bedroom, and it was filled with three beds covered in yellow candlewick bedspreads. And they were so jammed in, we actually couldn't get between the beds, and we crawled over the beds, and I just thought, oh, this is just amazing, you know, this is an amazing way to live. And Maria was very proud of her room, and I was just, it was so different from my own more stitched up kind of life. Anyway, when I was writing this book, I thought, I'll track Maria down. I haven't seen her for 50 years, and so, you know, it'll be good to get some memories jogged. So I found her on social media, and I flew down there and ended up in Dannevirke meeting her in a cafe one day, and we were having a good old chat, even though we hadn't seen each other for 50 years. I recognised her, she recognised me, and it was, you know, we had a great time. And I was saying, I really remembered your place. I remember your father was a fisherman, and I remember those dead sharks, those fetal baby sharks in that bucket in your hallway. That was amazing. And the boil up, that was new for me. And your bedroom, you know. And she just looked at me and she said, you never came to my place for lunch. My father was a shearer. He wasn't a fisherman. And I didn't have any sisters in the bed. And my mum never used to put boil up on the table. It was always served in bowls from the bench. And so I just sort of looked at her thinking, oh, my God, this is such important memory to me. It's so strong, the colours, the smells, everything about it. And I'd kind of traced, in my adult life, my fascination and enjoyment of the Māori world back to this kind of warm domestic moment. And it was all just a fantasy. Huh? And I discovered Maria and I weren't really close friends. I mean, I remembered her vividly, but she barely remembered me, really. She said she apologised for not selecting me for her softball team. She actually did remember that. And I said, oh, I don't remember that. Don't worry about it. You know, 50 years on, I thought that was really sweet of her. But it really made me reflect, what was my desire that was so strong that formed this wonderful childhood memory?
Let's come to the academic career, and I think initially you were an expert on the mating behaviour of the mallard duck. So yes. This wasn't you were in the science, studying science in the first iteration of the academic career. Mm. What was the path into and what was the role really of academia in your path into Te Ao Māori and the commitment that you've had to it academically and personally this long?
Yeah, well, I loved science at school, and in the early 70s I wanted to be a scientist. I went to study science, but it's hard to understand now, but in the early 70s it was actually quite hard to be a woman and to be taken seriously as a scientist. I know that, you know, you can't understand that now, but it really was the case. And I remember with a male friend of mine, we got our knickers in a twist about the ethics of what we were doing in our science degree, when we were pithing frogs and doing experiments on live chick fetuses and things like that. And at that stage, the scientists were saying, well, if you're interested in ethics, go over to philosophy. You know, we don't do that here. We just do experiments. And that might sound odd now, but that was the case then. And that combination of their being uninterested in the bigger ethical questions, plus, you know, the unsexiness, as I saw it, of women in science at that time, I went over and studied philosophy and social sciences, and eventually found myself, through a series of coincidences and friendships and so on, in education. It wasn't really where I particularly wanted to go, but I just ended up there. And education as an academic subject in New Zealand has been the one that's really attracted most Māori, I think. And so inevitably, I ended up teaching rather a few Māori women who became friends of mine, who I was taught by, about Te Ao Māori. And, you know, some of those people that were really at the forefront of the development of kaupapa Māori thinking, people like Linda Tuhiwai-Smith, Kuni Jenkins and so on, they were my students and were my teachers at the same time. And I got involved in supervising PhDs, for particularly Kuni Jenkins. She did a really interesting study on schooling and how schools came to New Zealand, Western schools, and how it was Māori who invited Western schools to New Zealand. They didn't just turn up one day. And I found that Māori-centred approach that looked at Māori as strategists rather than victims of our historical relationship just so fascinating and so absorbing. I just fell into it with both hands. And Kuni and I became close collaborators and wrote a couple of books. He Kōrero Words Between Us, First Māori Pākehā Conversations on Paper, which were about Māori engagement, early engagement with Western schooling in New Zealand. And the other one, of course, was Tuai, A Traveller in Two Worlds.
I think We spoke about that a couple of years ago, didn't we?
Yes, yeah. We did.
Yeah. What have been the moments on this journey for you that have been confronting for you? And again, where there has been a step change, where you've seen yourself in the mirror, I guess, as a Pākehā, or understood each other, understood yourself more deeply. Have there been moments that have been uncomfortable?
Yes, a number. I mean, I think probably the first time I was shocked and uncomfortable, and I recall this in the book, was when Dun Mihaka, again in the 70s, was doing his tour of universities in New Zealand, and I was down in Palmerston North at Massey University at the time, and I remember very vividly a gathering that was sort of loud and shouting, and mostly men sort of gathered around something, and I went and peered into this crowd, and in the middle was Dun Mihaka. Well, I didn't really know who he was, this Māori man, a very wiry, wild-looking guy. And he was sort of debating and leaping around, and almost like the whai kōrero that you might find, you know, on the marae, with all these Pākehā students standing around him sort of shouting back. And he was angry, but he was absolutely clear about what he was saying in terms of Māori land, Māori language, Māori rights, Māori law, etc. And I was completely riveted. But what confronted me was his anger. And I felt very anxious about that. I didn't want to be an object of Māori anger. I mean, like everybody else, I wanted us to all get on and have a cosy and best race relations in the world kind of relationship. That was my desire. I mean, I think that we all still have that desire in a sort of romantic fantasy kind of way. And that really confronted me. I thought, can I actually listen to this man, or am I just going to go and call, curl up in a fetal ball because Māori are angry with us Pākehā, and I'm actually a good Pākehā, so why is he angry? You know, it was that kind of slightly, I now see, self-pitying perspective that really took my attention to the kind of politics and the history of the relationship, and requiring me to actually give it some attention. And then, of course, through my university career, and it still happens, there are some Māori in the academy who are not particularly welcoming of Pākehā working on Māori questions or with Māori even. And so I get that a bit as well. You know, who are you, and butt out, and we can do this ourselves, and we don't need Pākehās, you know, in our face or whatever. And that's still part of my life, but I figure that's just part of the territory I'm on.
Interesting thing you just said there, I'm a good Pākehā, and is that something people have to get over as well, that somehow if they're good and they do things right and they mean well, that excludes them somehow from needing to accept anger or criticism or have the prism held up in front of them. I was recalling, what's that famous essay published just in the last while in the States? You know, what this was written by an African American writer saying, what do I do about you know, good white people meaning well? And the point of that essay is sometimes just listen. You don't have to speak. You have to say the right thing or do the right thing. Sometimes doing the right thing is just to listen and receive.
Exactly. Yeah, it's just the being open, and having a sense of humour, without having to dive in and saying, "Oh, let me make it better. Let me do something for you." I mean, we have a lot of Pākehā have this real sort of missionary zeal, saying, "Oh, I know things have been terrible, but let me come in and help you out." And you know, and Māori don't need that. I mean, Māori don't need Pākehā saying, "Let me help you out." Māori do need allies. And they do need people who will support their causes without trying to tell them what to do. And absolutely, I think listening and being quiet and not being expected to be taught. And this is one of the things that I have learned too, that a lot of Pākehā students will say to me, well, I want to know what Māori think, or I want to know what it's like to be Māori. And so they kind of expect that their Māori friends and colleagues are going to talk to them and tell them. And I find you to demand to be taught is to demand to be loved. You're demanding attention from somebody. And I think Pākehā have always demanded attention from Māori. You know, listen to what I'm saying. I'll tell you how to do it, and this is the correct way, and let me help you out, and listen to me. You know, and I think that to demand attention like that is not reasonable. I think we have to give ourselves attention, learn our own history, and pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps in terms of that relationship without relying on Māori to make us feel better, to make us feel redeemed from our you know, past lives or our history. And we do also, Pākehā, do have a strong desire for redemption, for Māori to say, yeah, you're okay, mate, you're okay. Now, Māori may say that to Pākehā, and that's a wonderfully generous, you know, thing to say. But we can't expect it, and I think our being an ally, being silent, being open, are all really aspects of being a good Pākehā, yes.
And being comfortable with discomfort, as you point out, there's a lot of people, isn't it, especially with the treaty process, who wanted it to end. They wanted it to end, and they wanted it to be passed, and everyone to be happy and everything to be settled. But that's not the story of any relationship. It's not the story of between the sexes. It's not the story between people of different ethnicities. It's not the story of any relationship, for that matter. It's about adjusting all the time and communicating all the time, and dealing in good faith all the time, one hopes. You can't just suddenly have discomfort at an end.
Yes, I think I'm really glad you picked up on that phrase that I use in the book, comfort with discomfort, or a sort of embracing of disappointment and embracing of discomfort. Because it's certainly the case that we're not going to wake up one sunny morning and say, you know, there's no more struggle between Māori and Pākehā now. We're all one. Well, that just is not going to happen. Because Tau Māori, the Māori world and the Pākehā world, if you like, and I'm putting that very simply, are different worlds. And they're always going to be in tension of some sort. Doesn't mean to say we can't live together and we can't really enrich each other. But it does mean that we're not going to always be and struggle with each other in a positive way.
It is personal, as we said, as well as a big picture memoir, Alison, and what is clear in a story in particular in the final chapter that's very personal to you. It's with your friend, Kuni. And was that one of the moments where you really went deeply into Te Ao Māori, in a spiritual way? Was it one of the things that has added to your life greatly by becoming so comfortable with and so immersed in this world? Have you had some pretty special moments?
Oh, yes, for sure. One of them I talk about in the book towards the end, I think that you're alluding to there, is me burying my breast, which had been removed. I had a mastectomy in a few years ago, 10-odd years ago, and burying it in the garden in my own sort of private little burial ceremony, suddenly realising I needed Kuni with me. She wasn't with me, but I had to ring her, and she really gave me some kind of spiritual strength that I didn't really until that moment know that I needed. And, you know, I often hear, or sometimes hear people, Māori sometimes saying, well, you Pākehās, get your own spiritual life. You know, you don't, why should you be just piggybacking on our spirit world and our spiritualness? And, you know, there's a sense in which that's absolutely true, but there's a sense also that as a Pākehā, I find immense comfort in the Māori spiritual world to the extent that I understand it, and just being around Māori, being at tangihanga, being at hui, being in Māori settings, you do get a sense of that spiritual world, and it does become partly your own. And so at that moment when I was in the garden with this sorry breast of mine, putting it into the garden, there was a fantail that came, a piwakawaka came around, Kuni on the phone talking to me. I felt I could be at peace, and it was an interesting moment for me, I guess, because I knew that it was the sort of context of the Māori spiritual world that I needed at that moment.
Thank you, Alison. Kia ora. Alison Jones. This Pākehā Life, an Unsettled Memoir, is published by Bridget Williams Books.